You're listening to Coach Your Brains Out by Gold Medal Squared. We'd like to thank our newest patron, Riley Salmon. Thank you for supporting the show. If you enjoy the show and can donate a couple bucks, please visit patreon.com/coachyourbrainsout. Welcome to Coach Your Brains Out, the show that explores learning from the top minds in volleyball and beyond. With your hosts, John Mayer, Billy Allen, Andrew Fuller, and Nils Nielsen.
Today, we're lucky to have on the show the current head coach at Fresno State, Jonathan Winder. Jonathan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
So many, many moons ago, we were teammates for one season at Pepperdine University. I wanted to know what you remember about that freshman year at Pep.
Yeah, it was a great year. You certainly remember winning the national championship. That was definitely at the top of the list. And yeah, a lot of coach on ones. Yeah, I think we had a pretty good team, and everybody was a little bit older. I was a young freshman on the team, and I think like our first side was really good, and then the second side was really competitive and really feisty. And Rick McLaughlin would run the show and set and kick people out of the gym, and and then there was just lots of trash talking in practices. And Marv would weight the score like crazy, and I remember it would be like, you'd have to get five before the other side would get, you know, two or something like that. But of your five, all of them had to be like perfect pass, first ball, side out kills. And so like the standard was just really high. And if you didn't meet the standard, it didn't matter about winning or losing. It was like, if you didn't meet the standard or weren't playing at your best, he was all over you. And so we got some good conditioning in and some dune runs and all that stuff. But yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was a good year. I actually had forgot that Rick McLaughlin, he's now the head coach at UCSB, he would set the second team, because we did, there was three setters on the roster, but all three of us were in the lineup with you setting. I was playing on the right and James Kaw playing libero. So we had three setters who were on that first team.
Yeah,
that's got to be pretty rare.
You came in and took John's position. Is that what happened?
Pretty easily.
John decided that he wanted to be an all opposite. And doubt for everybody. He was.
I remember going to hearing about Winder. You know, I'd started for 2 years at Pep, and they're like, "Yeah, there's this setter coming in next year." Like, oh, I can't be that good. And then I went to a club tournament, and he's 6'8", and he's mobile, and he's got really good hands. Like, all right, I better figure out another position.
I thought it was remarkable that, well, of course, you're an amazing volleyball player, you know, and but that you played libero in the off season, right? In like whatever the fall season, and James had played opposite, and a bunch of other people were playing opposite, and Marv had everybody playing kind of different positions, and then you show up the day after Christmas to start season, and here's your starting lineup. And everybody was playing a different position pretty much. You just had a bunch of really good volleyball players and a bunch of size. And you were able to pass really well and, you know, kill a bunch of balls and block everybody. And so I didn't have to dig anything.
No, I think we had a good game plan. It was just set Rooney. But we could go on this all day. I'd go in the old war stories. These are great. But let's get into it. We wanted to get in, since you were one of the best setters in the country and set on the national team, we wanted to take some time breaking down the skill of setting. So to start off, would you just tell us where you'd rank, as indoors this is, setting in order of importance? So if you were going to have a draft and you had your OH1, you know, OH2, the two middles, all these positions, where would you rank setter in that draft?
I know all the gold medal squared research and studies that show where these things end up. And I think for me, like in my experiences, both with the guy's side, the girl's side, and then internationally, it's hard. You don't really see too many good, really good teams without a really good setter. You know, you look at the national, you know, semifinals now with the Wisconsin setter is really good. Jenna Gray, of course, is really good at Stanford, and the Baylor setter was really good this year. And you know, and I think the Minnesota setter was good, but kind of injured, and so they had a hard time getting going last night. But it seems like you need to have the OH1 is the primary person. And as I was thinking about this question, I think for me, I would always take one great outside and two medium setters. you know, versus one great setter and two medium outsides. And so I would put the setter probably second or third for me, just because I think that to be really, really good, you have to have a really good setter. You just don't see it too often. I haven't seen it, you know, of course, in the international game, you're not really in a 6-2. You do a little double sub every once in a while, but for the most part, you get pretty limited by the ability of your setter. And so if I wanted to build a championship team, I'd want to make sure I had a setter that could play at a high level.
And to start getting into the fundamentals of setting, can you take us through your setting keys?
Yeah. So of course there's the, I guess it depends on who I'm teaching setting to, but I think with, you know, the basics, you've got the GMS kind of, you know, fundamentals that I use with the, you know, ball shaped hands, extend to your target and face ball finish target, all that stuff. And, but then when it comes to setting or to, sorry, teaching setters in general, I think a lot about balance is a big thing for me, and just being under control. I know maybe we'll chat about it a little bit later what I look for in setters, but I think it's really important to move well. And so the keys, kind of one of the first things is making sure that they understand how to move out of serve receive and have all their movement patterns in place. I think it's just really important to be balanced and under control so that you can just use your arms or hands to set the ball. And then kind of the, this word came up in setting that I've ended up using a lot as I've taught. And I didn't really use it as a player or think about it as a player, but certainly when I've been teaching setters the last 5-6 years, the word impulse is how we've best described the set, you know, kind of this instinctual force through the ball. And so what I tend to try to do is to get the setters to understand what that feels like, to really get this impulse, this one move through the ball where it feels like they're not really touching the ball and it just kind of, you know, flies out of their hands. And a guy, Terry Daniluk, who was the head coach at University of Alberta for a long time and great Canadian player and coach, he kind of brought that up to me, and it just made a lot of sense to me to really describe what does it feel like to get the ball out of your hands really well, because that's kind of the big part of setting for me is just being balanced, and then ultimately your ball, your hands are what sets the ball, right? What makes the ball go from point A to point B. And so I think how you finish is critical. And so then we use a couple of keys along the way with you know, having your hands ready, making sure you read the pass. I think, you know, seeing the pass is huge, and just being balanced. And so read the pass is one of them. Getting your feet to the ball. You know, I hear setter or coaches around the country always talk about just getting squared up. And I think that's a part of it. You know, we'll use the right foot pivot, left foot pivot, little jump set, all that stuff. And ultimately it's about, you know, getting your feet around and squared up. Maybe sometimes we'll say, get your right foot to the ball, or take the ball over your lead leg, will be something we'll use. Neutral contact, you know, taking it in the same spot every time. And then we talked about just how we finish, you know, this impulse or a fast finish, full finish, palms to target. I'm giving you a bunch of different keys because I think I've seen it connect in a lot of different ways, that when I've tried to be like, hey, you just got to get a neutral contact, it just doesn't always connect with every player. And so I think with setting and teaching volleyball in general, it's not like one size fits all. I think with the words you use, I think you have to teach. And so you have to come up with a variety of ways to, you know, get the point across and get them to understand and feel what you want them to feel. And yeah, so I think in general, those are probably some of the general keys that I'll use quite a bit of, but really the foundation is about being balanced and, you know, being under control, and then allowing you just to really use your hands to set the ball, and having kind of that one move through the ball so it gets out pretty quick and clean.
How do you know if a key is connected? How do you tell if it's the right one?
Certainly, I think the way the ball comes out of their hands is one thing, and seeing it done, you know, thousands, millions of times, and watching somebody kind of not be able to do it and then start to get closer to the vision of what it's supposed to look like. I think always in my mind, you have to define current reality. You have to know what current reality looks like. You know, you need to know what your setters look like and move like, and then have a vision of what that looks like. And I think the player needs to know that as well. And so showing them on film of somebody doing it really well, or you doing it really well, and so that they have a really clear understanding of where they're trying to go. I think you have to, in order to let go, you have to know where you're going to go, because you're always a little bit of fear and afraid of kind of like, especially with setting, I think there's, you get some more nerves involved with kind of letting go of some of the past movements. And so for me, that's always kind of important. And so when it comes to kind of trying to figure out if they get the key or not, over time, if it's not coming in place and they're not, it's not happening, you know, over a bunch of reps, then I'll try to use another key or cue to try to get the same exact message across.
And how do you, you mentioned the importance of balance. How do you teach balance? I think you said you talked about movement patterns. Can you describe what that looks like? Maybe some drills you do to work with your setters?
Yeah, certainly just, I think there's no substitute for the reality of, you know, rotation one entries and right, left, right, you know. And so certainly we'll practice those movements quite a bit. And that was something that I remember doing when I was in eighth grade, ninth grade, when I started setting in high school. I went to played at a club, Balboa Bay Volleyball Club, where Kevin Hansen played, Brian Thornton, and Brandon Taliaferro, a bunch of really good setters. I think at one point when I was on the national team, three of the four setters in the gym, we were all 1 year apart from each other in from Balboa. And I thought, I just, wow. That always really just took me back at the level of teaching and consistency that they had over the years just to develop good volleyball players. And so anyways, I remember doing that tons was just the footwork patterns, you know, over and over and over again. And so that was something that always allowed me to have a little bit of control, just understanding my steps and the amount of steps that I'm taking to the ball, and big ones and small ones and stutter steps and all that in between. And so for sure doing that. And then once you get to the ball, is just having a good understanding of what does it feel like to be under control. You know, are you drifting? Like, you know, we have the little TiVo things, and it's like, you took off from here at this line and you landed over here at this line. Okay, why did you do that? What happened here? Clearly there's this massive drift, and then the ball, then kind of seeing it and connecting the outcome. It's like, okay, you drifted 5 feet. The ball went 5 feet wide. There you go. There's your answer. And let's try not to do that anymore. I think that's what we work on in recruiting. I'm sure you have athletes that have some body control.
And how do your keys vary if you're working with a high school player?
The same. Yeah, I don't. I'll do a bunch of clinics and things like that around here. And we did it when I was at Washington. And it's the same fundamentals and keys and concepts. And certainly, like, I'm even looking for that as we recruit. And you're always kind of paying attention to people that are moving the same way. I think it's pretty consistent, you know, at the international level and on the national teams are watching these, you know, the NCAA tournament right now. A lot of the great setters are moving really, really similarly. And I think even the better setters in high school do the same stuff, and they just do it more and more and more as they get into college. So I wouldn't change the keys or concepts.
So when you're with your setters at Fresno State, say day one, and you're just, you know, you have, maybe it's a freshman or a new player, how are you introducing all these concepts and this terminology and these keys? What sort of practice environment is it?
Yeah, I think it's really different for the athlete. Like this year, we had a senior setter. So I took over this program. Right. And so I remember with the setters I inherited, it was just one thing at a time. And so I guess to start with, I showed them all five keys, you know, that we use, and kind of went through each, you know, over the course of a couple weeks maybe. But then then kind of just went to square one and was just spending a lot of time on reading the pass and kind of really making sure they're watching the passer's arms and getting a read on where this ball is going to go and that they don't get antsy and kind of freak out, you know, when the pass is coming and can kind of hang out there and really make a good read so they can move well to the ball. And so that is just a lot of time of reps of, you know, the ball coming off of a actual passer as opposed to just off of a toss. And so just going one thing at a time and until they get it, we wouldn't move on to the next key. And so, you know, early on, especially when it comes to trying to teach somebody how to see well, it takes a little while. And so that's what I try to do is to go one thing at a time. I played for a coach actually in Poland. That's a great coach. He's the Mariusz Sordiel. He's the coach of Fenerbahce, I think, of the men's team in Turkey right now. But he kind of showed me don't give a ton of feedback to setters in a row. It really like messed me up. And that it would be like, hey, your feet are off. Hey, your hands are off. Oh, the ball's going too wide. You're drifting to your left, drifting to the right. And then all of a sudden I'm everywhere. And like, I couldn't focus on just getting the ball from out of my hands to the hitter. And, cause I was thinking about 80 different things that I needed to do. And, so for me, that was a big lesson of just kind of go one thing at a time. And even if there's other things that are happening that you don't like, or they need to address is it's important to go one thing at a time. It's hard to kind of come back and, or you get frustrated at the end because all of a sudden you're coming back to something that you thought they knew, but you didn't really focus on it long enough to make it a habit.
Was that coach, the Poland coach, was he doing that because he was trying to coach you that way, or he was trying to show you how ineffective that was to focus on all those things?
Oh, he was coaching me that way.
Oh, yeah. I see.
Okay. So it was really frustrating.
Yeah, that sounds not so good. But I don't think it's uncommon.
Like, he knew what he was talking about. He was a great mind, great player, great coach, I think. And, but just in how that was being communicated to me at that point in time, it was really, not an enjoyable process and not helpful for me as a setter.
Yeah. Doesn't sound very effective. How much time do you usually spend each practice working on technique? Say you've already gone through all the keys and, but yeah, I guess how often each day are you working on technique with your setters?
Yeah, I think, like you guys know, the college game is a little bit different. You get not a lot of time for a certain portion of the off season. And then you get a lot of time at certain other times of the year. So it can really vary. But, like we had, two new setters this year. And so they both would come in this is during the last fall. So during season, you know, they would come in before school would start and set for like an hour, maybe two or three times a week. And, cause they were kind of trying to play catch up with understanding the game and how to move and, kind of the keys and fundamentals and, in order to, you know, locate the tempo and, everything a little bit better. And so that was during the season. During practice, you know, once we get the team practice going, I'll probably spend 15, 30 minutes with the setters. And then, before practice usually, and in the off season, it's a ton though. That's probably where I would do it the most is in, you know, for us, it's in the January, February, March, where it's, I don't know, maybe half their time is going to be on setting. And, I don't do a ton of stuff like off of a toss unless I'm really trying to just get one little, get them to understand one thing, you know, and maybe they're not understanding it at all. And so I'll kind of work my way back to going off of a toss, or sometimes I've had them like sit on a box or whatever it is to try to get just kind of one little element in place, or to have them feel one little thing. But ultimately trying to go live as much as possible. And because I think it's really different setting into a ring, you know, or setting to somebody who catches it versus setting to a hitter. And same thing, like setting, it's one, like sometimes I'll do one drill where you set to somebody on a box, but then they tip or hit it at the passer because then it's pretty important to learn how to set out of tip coverage and out of transition. Again, when you're kind of on the move and things are more random and it's harder to get squared up and to finish to your target and you take the ball a little bit on the left or all these things start happening more, fatigue kicks in. And, so I just think that it's, pretty important to kind of get it into that random game-like phase, especially once they kind of have a good understanding of how to move.
And once you guys move into more of the competition part of practice, are you still giving technical feedback to your setters? And if so, what does that feedback sound like?
Yeah, not as much, to be honest. With the once we're competing, I again, kind of like from based upon my experiences as a setter, I mean, John was there. Like, I didn't get, I don't remember too many, like, you know, hour, 30 minute, like, setting instructional things with Marv when I was at Pepperdine. I remember he taught me how to back, or he brought Rod Wild in one time to teach me how to back set. And it was like one practice. And then that's what I worked on for the next 6 months, was just back setting from that one practice. You know, I remember Rick teaching me how to set a high ball in my freshman year. And that was like the one thing. Otherwise, it was really just kind of like maybe little subtle reminders along the way. But for the most part, I think you kind of have to learn and explore it. And so for me, what I try to do is to have them have one thing. You've got one thing you're working on today as a volleyball player, as a setter, and then we'll track it. You know, I'll try to give you feedback on it throughout, kind of check in on it, ask you how you're doing with it throughout practice. And then after practice or in matches, I can say, hey, you know, 18 out of 50 times you had your hands ready when the passer was passing the ball. So you were ready to receive that pass. And can we get it to, you know, 20 out of 50 in the next practice? And so they're just trying to track it over time and until it kind of becomes a habit.
And what do you do to develop the connection between setters and hitters?
You get them talking to each other. I've actually thought it was harder. It's been harder with girls. Guys are usually a little bit more blunt and just kind of like, dude, that set sucked, you know, or set it higher, set it lower. With girls, there's a little bit more to it. It, at least in my experiences in the last 5 or 6 years, where there's a little bit more emotion attached with it of like, she doesn't like me and she doesn't think I'm a good setter or whatever it might be. And so there's just a little bit more to it, I think, with the communication there. And so certainly there's like a feedback loop, you know, you try to get the hitters and really to understand their timing and rhythm and make sure they are dialed in with, you know, when the ball's in the setter's hands, I'm on this step, I'm you know, on my hard second step or the soft second step, whatever it is. And so they have to know that. Otherwise, I don't feel that they have the right to give feedback. And so when hitters just kind of roll out there and, you know, day one as a freshman, you're telling a senior setter, set it higher, lower, faster, whatever, but you have no clue what you're doing. I don't see that being productive and helpful for anybody. And so it's important that they know how they move as hitters so that they can give proper feedback and that they keep it pretty specific. And I thought it's best when they do it after they do something well. So like if the set's low and inside and they hit it and kill it, they can say, hey, you know, push it out a little wider. Okay, I get it, you know. And then but if they if I set it low and inside and you hit it in the bottom of the net and then you tell me and yell at me and say, hey, higher, you know, and you're kind of blowing up the setter, I think that's not helpful for the setter. It's not helpful for their confidence. And so I'm not a big fan of that, because you don't. I remember Marv talking about it one time. You don't really want the passers to be, or the setter to be yelling at the passer like pass it better, and the hitters to be yelling at the setter to set it better, and it just gets out of control.
How would you respond when you had hitters, you know, say higher or whatever, give you critical feedback?
I was a little up and down in my career, I think, with that, and. I think as it went on, like you have to better, I don't know, I think the better setters that are more confident and can just kind of take it to a certain degree and they're okay carrying the burden, you know, they're not as stressed or worried. And so they can carry more of the burden and say, hey, that was my bad. That was not a good set, even if it was a great set, right? They could kind of like lighten the load for the hitters. And I think that's a really good quality of setters when they can do that. for me, like I remember, I'd get after hitters sometimes if they were to say in that stuff like that, then I would just say, well, I'm just not going to set you again. Like, why would I set you if you're just whining about my sets? And, that doesn't, you know, that's probably not too helpful, but I would definitely be a little bit feisty with, how I would communicate from time to time with hitters, especially when it wasn't, when I didn't feel like it was productive. And the other part I would say is like, I know as I don't know, as certainly as I went on in my career, you know, if it's a good set, like the second it touches your hands, probably even before it comes out of your hands, you know, if it's going to be in the target or not, you know, or at least in the zone where they can really do something with it. And so you don't really need a whole lot of feedback, in my opinion. And maybe early on you need to, but like, I would be pretty surprised if like Jenna Gray and Catherine Plummer are still working on how to, you know, figure out what is her set like. You know, they've both been setting each other for a really long time. And so as it kind of moves forward, I don't think you really need a ton of feedback, you know, because I think everybody kind of knows what that set's like.
I remember when I made the switch when you came to Pepperdine from going from setter to hitter, I was like, I am never going to complain about a set. If you set me wherever it goes, like I'm still like after going through a couple of years of hearing about it, it's like I will never give any sort of negative, like more just like thanks for setting me.
Yeah,
I don't think you really understand it as a hitter. You don't understand it unless you've been through it, and you know how hard it's really hard to locate the ball and as often as you want to, as accurately as you want to.
Yeah, I think especially when you're young or kind of figuring things out, it can be really stressful to get. You're getting feedback from everywhere. You know, you're getting it from your coach. You're getting it from, whether it's verbal or nonverbal, sometimes you just see the reaction in your hitters, you know, and then that like deflates you, and or you see the fans, or you set a ball and then everybody's screaming that it's supposed to be a double, you know, and the ref doesn't call it, or the ref calls a double. Like I know from my experience, setters I've coached have had a really hard time when they do get called for a double. I was watching the Baylor game, and the setter there seems to be really, really a nice player. And she doubled a couple balls, or it was a little bit, you know, missed timings. And all of a sudden you could see the confidence and kind of the stress kind of go kick in. And that becomes really difficult to manage, I think, as a coach and as a team. And then all of a sudden what you've done for months gets thrown off, and that's not very helpful. So yeah. A little bit aware of those things.
Right. What about the other way for setters who are communicating to hitters? What do you recommend, say, if an attacker is really struggling, or even if they're going good, what do you have your setters focus on when they communicate?
Yeah, I think that kind of like I mentioned before, with trying to take accountability and responsibility as much as possible, because it kind of goes both ways, that I think like on a team or in these got all these relationships that are on the court, right? And somebody's going to be a little bit more confident. Somebody's going to be a little bit more mature than somebody else on the team. They've got six individuals out there, right? And so not everybody's going to be at the same confidence level, maturity level, the entire match, the entire practice, right? It's going to be a little up and a little down. And so I think for setters, when they can take on more responsibility, I think that's really helpful. When they can lighten the load of the hitters, who can also feel stressed, like when they're hitting the ball out of bounds or struggling, that they can say, hey, I'm going to keep setting you. That's my bad on that set. Like, you know, that was a great swing, even if though it was 25 feet out of bounds. Like, you know, you can just kind of ignore the bad stuff and stay focused on the positive and continuing to connect with and give high fives and pull for your hitters that aren't doing very well. And the ones that are doing well, you just keep building them up. You know, nobody can stop you. I'm going to set you every freaking ball here. You keep swinging as hard as you can, and I'm going to find you, you know, and just kind of continuing to invest in them and believe in them and make sure they know that you're not going anywhere, and you're going to, yeah, I might set this person one or two times, but it's because I want to set you at the end of the game and get you the kill to win the match kind of thing. So I think I like telling people when I'm going to set them. And sometimes I like telling them I'm going to set them and then don't set them, just to make sure they're approaching hard.
Yeah.
Especially with middles.
Yeah. You always got to tell middles you're going to set them. We want to get into tactics a little bit. How important do you think deception is in setting?
Yeah, probably more a fan of decision making than deception. I think the deception is important, but it happens, I think, just with when you're just a good setter and when you move really well. You know, when you get squared up, when you get the ball in the same spot on top of your head, like all of a sudden you're being deceptive just by moving well, right? And it's not so much about delay setting or kind of holding on to the ball for a long time or something like that. I think just the better you move, the more deceptive it is. It just becomes really difficult to see that ball fly out of your hands. And when you have a good high contact and get that impulse, that ball flying out, it's just, I think that's really deceptive. And so I don't spend too much time on it. I'd probably a little bit more on decision making, and then also just the ability to go against the flow and the strength to kind of move the ball around and set it wherever you want to set it. You know, regardless of the pass, that would be the ideal. Being deceptive is just being able to make it look like I'm going to set one thing. You know, we always square up to the left side, so kind of always looking like I'm going to set a quick or set a go, but then ultimately I set whoever I want. But that's really just about moving really well.
That was part one of our conversation with Jonathan Winder. Join us next week for more setting talk here on Coach Your Brains Out by Gold Medal Squared. You're listening to Coach Your Brains Out by Gold Medal Squared. This is part two of our conversation with Jonathan Winder.
Welcome to Coach Your Brains Out, the show that explores learning from the top minds in volleyball and beyond. With your hosts, John Mayer, Billy Allen, Andrew Fuller, and Nils Nielsen.
Can you talk more about decision making? Do you want your setters thinking more about the blocking matchups or just more about their own hitter strengths? How do you teach decision making?
Yeah, I think it's mostly about the blocking matchups for me. But that kind of goes into your hitter strengths. Like, if you have Catherine Plummer, it doesn't really matter who's blocking, you know. So every matchup is a great matchup when she's spiking, right? And but otherwise, it becomes, you know, a little bit tighter. And so one of the things I used to do is to I think maybe we'll talk about this a little later, but just to always pick up on who's blocking on the other side, who are my hitters, and in the split seconds you have in between each rally is to make some kind of initial decisions. And I like to visualize it. And so in the 5 seconds you have, you kind of see, okay, I've got John going against Billy. All right, I'm taking John here. And and so then I would kind of watch myself. I kind of watch myself set it, like in my mind, right? A little visualization of me. Here's the perfect pass. I'm setting John. Okay, and then on a medium pass or a bad pass, I know that I've got Rooney on the outside. And so, yeah, no brainer. I'm setting Rooney. And then that was, you know, kind of the decision-making process is to have a plan A on a good pass and the plan B on a bad pass. And it's kind of like your outlet. And it allowed me to kind of lower the stress. And I think it allows setters to lower the stress. Because I've coached some setters that have not thought at all, and they don't think about matchups or anything when they set. And it's nice that they are setting free and just kind of flinging the ball around, but not very helpful when it comes to really attacking an off or attacking a defense. And so I think there's a little bit of a balance there, and when you can kind of without being like so rigid, kind of predetermining some things and kind of knowing the matchups ahead of time, it kind of allows you then to just set the ball. You already made the decision. You already watched yourself do it. And so you're just out there and you're doing it. And and so that's how I tend to do the decision-making stuff, is to really talk about the matchups and maybe afterwards really trying to make sure that in training that the setters are practicing that and are noticing the, you know, the middles went to the left over here, they went to the right here, the blocker helped on this side, you know, and kind of trying to make a, training the setters to make a long list, just kind of a running total of what is this blocker like? You know, how is this hitter doing right now? You know, I've set John 12 times and he has at least 8 kills. It seems like every time I set him, it's a really quality swing. Well, I'm going to feel pretty comfortable, and you should probably feel pretty comfortable to set that person. And I think the better setters can kind of keep a running tally of, you know, of kind of what's happening in the match.
And how far does that, does it go like A, B, C, D, or does it stop at B? How far do you go down that?
I would only do B, kind of like, because I think there's like a good pass or medium pass, and hopefully I'm pretty good that I can set, you know, the same person on a perfect or medium pass. And then you kind of have your, you know, worst pass situation. You know, in men's volleyball, you typically have a D, right? Or you have somebody on the left side. So you almost always have two people. I think in women's volleyball, you don't necessarily have that. More people are running bics now and out of the back row. But usually you're better off just setting the ball to the left side. And so usually with our setters here, it's probably more so like, here's a high, tight, perfect pass. And here's my choice. And then as it gets to about 10 feet off the net, here's, you know, plan B. I'm either going to the go or the red, or, you know, maybe I'm going to throw in a quick if I've got a pretty good hitter, but that's probably the A and B.
And is this, so let's say the play ends and then the setter realizes, okay, we're in row two. Do they go through the A, B then before the next whistle blows? Or is this like done pre-match where you go through each rotation and have that A, B figured out?
Yeah, we'll certainly go through it pre-match to kind of walk through the rotations. I'd like to do that, but it's definitely in the match, you know, as it's happening, because people change, players change, somebody's going to be hitting well, not well. But the other thing I would add is that ultimately for a setter, you have to set what you're comfortable setting, and you have to be confident setting a certain one. I remember as a setter for me, I wasn't very confident setting the wide gap. That was like one of the sets I didn't like very much. And so I would really only set it when it was a short distance play, you know? And so if Rick or Marv or whoever had told me, hey, you've got to set a wide gap to, you know, to John here, I would say, okay, great. And then I would get out into the game. And if the pass was in zone two or something like that, no way, because I would feel not confident, and that if I did set it, I would like double it, or it would be not hittable, right? And so I would rather set, you know, a short distance red or a long distance go or something like that that I knew would be a much more quality set. I think the location and tempo is always way more important than your deception or decision making, and it's by a long shot. And so yeah, I think that is pretty important. So the setters might have their little visualization of what they're going to do in each rotation. And as whenever they have time and kind of have the time to break down the matchup, you know, they just need a couple seconds to do it. And then, but ultimately then it's really just understanding what does your setter feel comfortable setting at this point in time. And you have to know that. You have to make a game plan that matches, you know, your setter's strengths, as opposed to trying to put them in a position of weakness and just saying, oh, you know, here's a good matchup against this person, but I have a setter that can't set the ball that would be best there. And so I either need to change the setter or change my matchup, or, you know, change my options there.
And how did you like to be coached as a setter during timeouts? What was most helpful to hear?
Not a lot. Yeah, I think for me, just kind of on the game plan, I remember when I first got to Pepperdine, Rick would just tell me who to set every time. 90% of the time, it was Rooney. It was kind of like Rick would just say, hey, run, you know, this person, this quick on a tight quick and set a go. Run a wide gap and set Mayer on a red. And so that was always really helpful for me, because it was just really clear he was confident in his decision. And so then I just was like, okay, sounds good. And you go out there and you do it. So you're kind of taking away any like worry or concern that the players might feel about, you know, what should happen, what could happen. So that was always helpful for me. And that's how I like to do it still, is probably don't give a ton of feedback, certainly not a ton of technical stuff, and just mostly about kind of the game plan thing, reminding setters who's hitting well, who's not hitting well, and just kind of, you know, maybe reminders about the general game plan, like, hey, we want to set some quick here early, and trying to set, you know, somebody at the end of the game. And so we really want to establish something else early on.
So then outside of the setting skills, what are some skills you prioritize and spend the most time on with setters? You know, things like leadership, defense, serving.
Yeah. I think serving is huge. Spend a ton of time there. And then maybe it just depends on the type of setter you have. Like some of the kids I coach at Washington or Pepperdine or here tended to be a little bit more on needing to spend some more time with digging balls. You know, you're back there for sure. We've done a mix of a 6-2 and a 5-1. And so some setters, you know, that need more time blocking, some need more time digging, but for sure serving is a huge part of it. And certainly leadership, that's a part of it, as a part of the conversation. But for me, I just think for me, one of the priorities of our program is to be a great serving team. And yeah, and so I've seen the value of serve on the game. And if you have a setter that has a lame serve, or if you're in a 6-2 and you have two setters that can't serve, that's two big opportunities and you can't take them out. You know, and so I think the serve is something that's really, really important. And maybe third would be digging balls, the ability to extend some rallies. And I've coached a few teams with setters that had a hard time digging the ball, and you have to change a lot of different stuff to try to kind of mitigate that.
What about when you're recruiting setters? Was there anything that stands out that's valuable that you're looking for?
I think, like I said earlier, I like volleyball athletes. Marv always talked about this. And like John was saying, we had three setters our freshman year on our starting side playing different positions. I think this year we had a kid on our team, Julia Handy, that had played at Arizona, then transferred to us. And she was a setter, but then she ended up playing as a opposite in a bunch of games because she's a good volleyball player. And so she started for us at opposite. She started for us as a passer. She played as a DS for us, and then she also set for us and started towards the end of the season in a 6-2 as a setter. And so for me, like, just volleyball athletes, I think when I look for setters, whether it was at Washington or with men's volleyball when I was at Pepperdine, in recruiting and evaluating, you want really good athletes, and they can run around and jump and dive and hit the floor, and you know, hopefully they're long and have big hands and all that stuff and are pretty athletic. So those are certainly just some physical things we'll look for. And I like setters that are kind of feisty and competitive, you know, that are out there pretty confident, and we'll talk to the referees, we'll talk to their teammates, we'll stay connected with everybody, and just, yeah, really, really compete. I like to watch setters at the end of games and see how they handle when the stress picks up. You know, how's their location when it's 25 all? I think it's different when it's 0-0 versus 25-24 or the matches on the line. I've not taken a lot of setters over the course of time because of watching them choke in end of games. And I don't know, for me, that was always something that's kind of like stood out with some of the better setters as I've like watched them in high school. Like two setters I recruited and spent a lot of time with right now, the one at Washington, of course, and then the kid at Penn State, Gabby Blossom. And they both were really, really competitive kids when they were in high school, and just they'd be talking up to the refs and their teammates and moving the ball around and setting anyone anywhere, anytime. And so that was always something that really stood out to me, was kind of their mindset at different parts of the game, and important to kind of watch that with setters. And ultimately it's about their location and tempo. So if somebody's just setting high balls all the time, it becomes really difficult to then locate it when they need to set it fast. And if they can only set it fast, you know, on perfect passes, like that's one thing, but you need to be able to do it on medium passes and kind of be able to adjust tempo and location. So the tempo and location piece is the priority. And then maybe the athleticism is number two. And kind of the mindset, leadership, some of that stuff is competitiveness is number three, toughness.
Do you think the feisty competitiveness, is that trainable? Like if you had an athlete you're recruiting and they checked some of the boxes but didn't have that, would you feel like you could teach it, or is that more just an innate thing?
Yeah, I'm sure you can teach it. It's just a matter of time, right? Like, you can teach anything. Anything is learned. I believe that everything is learned, and values are learned, behaviors are learned. But it's just a matter of how much time do you have to do it. In college, we have 4 years, you know, so sometimes I'll try to get it going with somebody in high school if they've committed early, or sometimes you only have somebody for 2 years or 1 year, and I don't know if you can learn the requisite amount of competitiveness in a year or two. So I would tend to say probably not. And I think it's a little more, you'll get, I don't know, more return faster to teach them the fundamentals of like how to move versus how to be competitive. Is really tough.
That makes sense. So I'm sure as you've been around the country and recruited a lot, you've seen a lot of fundamentals that are kind of frustrating to watch in different gyms. So if you could go around to different clubs around the country, what would be some of the big rocks that you give them to focus on when they're training setters?
The one thing that always bothers me is that setters don't really know how to back set. That was something that always stood out to me as I go around and watch teams. I know some like clubs don't really have, they like almost like don't teach their setters to run, you know, to set the ball behind. And maybe because they don't have slide hitters or opposites that are really spiking. But it just really deters the development of setters if they can't set the ball to different spots. And you know, I think from a fundamentals or qualities that are frustrating for me, that tends to be one, is just watching setters not ever set the ball back. And but yeah, otherwise, I think a lot of people seem to be doing a lot of different stuff. And the other part, maybe sometimes that's frustrating for me, is just not it always coming off of a toss. I think maybe a little bit off of a toss, but you got to learn how to set the ball when it's coming off of somebody's arms, and how to kind of read that and move accordingly.
Cool. And we have some listener and patron questions for you. So this first one's from patron Nick Enriquez. How do you teach the details of all the different decisions setters have to make at a young age?
Like I mentioned before, I think it's best when it's just in a conversation, when it's constant conversation, and it's not uncomfortable for me to ask you, hey, what did that blocker do here? And if you don't know, you don't know. And then we move on again. But I'm really just trying to increase awareness of the game. Like, you want your junior setters to be aware of who's hitting, you know? And so that sometimes is just maybe step one, is who are your three hitters or two hitters on your side, you know? And what are you telling them? Where are you telling them to go? And so just asking asking a lot of questions of your setters in more of a conversational way, and being able to develop the relationship to say, hey, you know, why did you tell Abby to go on a slide when, you know, Catherine Plummer was blocking against her? Maybe not a great matchup there, you know? And so just really trying to increase awareness, I would say, would be more of the focus probably at the junior level, of understanding the what's happening around me, what's happening on the court, being able to see, you know, my hitters, their blockers, and ultimately, like, off the court, to have conversations about strategy of setting. I remember when I took over at Washington, the setters, they didn't know what like a isolate was or how to overload somebody, you know, and I thought that was pretty straightforward. So that was something I had learned when I was in club at the junior level, and just kind of knowing if I set a gap and I set over it, what is that going to do to the blockers? You know, if I put the middle over here, if I put the middle here, and just kind of having an understanding there. And so I would probably have those conversations in the airport before practice, after practice, and kind of just talking about general volleyball strategy.
And Keegan Cook, head coach at UW, asks, what would you have done differently as an assistant, knowing what you know now as a head coach?
What would I have done different?
Sounds like he's complaining a little bit. I don't know.
Yeah.
I think you've had him on this show, right?
Before? Yeah, he's great.
He's
yeah.
basically telling you, see, it's harder than you thought.
Yeah. I probably would be more patient. I think would be one thing I would have done different. I think that there's a lot of pressure to win, to play well, to get things in place. And some things take longer than others. And but maybe I'd, yeah. So I just think about patience probably being something that I've learned a little bit more as a head coach, is there can be value in waiting, and value in kind of staying with one thing over a long period of time, and just knowing that that thing is critical and it needs to get in place, as opposed to kind of jumping to something else, or just saying, oh, they don't get it, or it's not, they're never going to get it, or something like that. Yeah, that'll probably be it.
And Keegan has a follow-up. Besides your wife's patience, what are your principles for managing a young family and your career?
Yeah, definitely a good wife. Oh, it's a lot. I'm due with my fourth kid here. So kids take up a lot of time. And it for me, it's been important to just be as present. You know, we talked about being where your feet are is something that seems to keep coming up. And when I'm home, be home. And when the kids are awake, and usually, you know, like the day starts at 6 or 7 and it goes till 6 or 7 in the office. And then I'm home with the kids for maybe an hour or two before they go to bed, and just trying to be really present there and not thinking about practice or the work I'm going to do after they go to bed. So that's been something that's been really helpful and important. At the same time, is just to have really good dialogue. I think with my wife has been helpful for me, is just that she really understands how I view work, and that's my way of really being a part of the family and providing for the family. And that's my way of kind of showing my love for the family, is doing the best that I can to provide, you know, as best I can. And so really being dialed in with what she needs, and being able to support her and sacrifice, you know, at work as I can. And then at the same way, you know, with her, is just being able to sacrifice time with family every once in a while in order to get the program and the team where it needs to go. So it's kind of this constant give and take, and it's probably never a perfect balance. You know, it seems like it's over time been a little bit best when it's just kind of understanding the rhythms of the season. There's probably 6 different seasons as a college coach, with summer and fall and winter and spring, and all the hours are really, really different. Like the next 2 weeks, I'm basically going to be off, you know, and but in season you go 7 days a week and, you know, 12, 15 hour days or whatever it is. And that's just kind of a season. And so me understanding that, her understanding that, and just knowing, and then making sure that when we do have time, that I'm really, really present in the later in the year when that time kind of comes back, to being really present with the family.
Nice. So former teammate JD Schleppenbach asks, can you share a memory that stands out from your time at Pepperdine, whether related to actually playing or just off the court with the team?
Yeah, a lot of memories. What's a good one? Yeah, I think Marv was really good, of course, as a coach, as a teacher, and motivator. I think, like, to me, the best thing was always the practices. And JD probably doesn't want me to throw him under the bus, but I remember him and John Grobe getting into a fight in the locker room, and where they were punching each other. I think it was over like a seam responsibility. It wasn't really like, you know, something serious, but I just, for me, the practice environment was the best I had ever been a part of, whether it was at the national team or the professional teams I was on. I'd never played in a environment that was so intense and competitive and hard and demanding and enjoyable. Like, there were so many different things that you felt at the end of the practice. And so I for sure remember, you know, moments like that with JD and John. And I remember moments of getting, I remember I got really mad at Adam Black, who was our assistant coach one time, and who he messed up the score. And I just started, I think I was cussing him out because he messed up the score and I was going to lose and going to have to go run the sand dune or something crazy. And just, I cared so much. And, but it wasn't right on my behalf to do that. You know, it wasn't my place. It wasn't, you know, he was just his assistant coach doing the score and not right for a player to do that. And so Marv just absolutely crushed me and was doing a coach on one up in the bleachers of Firestone Fieldhouse, diving on the carpet and in between the chairs. And, you know, and like, that was a, like, it's a memory that I remember in part because it was really hard, but also just like, he was so good about creating like space and freedom and creating this environment for you to be free to play, to explore, to compete, to yell, scream, like kind of get after it, but then would definitely be disciplined with, you know, how you behave. And there were certain lines that were never crossed. And certainly one of them is that, or talk about like cussing in the gym or just some of these other cultural things. And, so some of the best memories I have are of, just the practices, the really difficult practices and, just competing in that gym.
What made the practices so competitive? Was it the fact that you did have to run the sand dune after, or what was the magic there?
I don't know. You know, I work with a guy, there's a professor here, his name's Wade Gilbert. He's one of the world's experts in coaching. And, he wrote a book, Coaching Better Every Season. And, so he goes all over the world. And one of the things he talks a lot about is, like the best coaches are environmental engineers, right? They're trying to create this environment that, is really aware. They're hyper aware of what does the athlete feel when they're practicing? What do they feel when they leave? Right. And, you know, are they tired? Are they exhausted? Are they mentally challenged? You know, are they happy? You know, what is that feeling? And, so I don't know how Marv did it. I don't know how he built it. You know, I just was there mostly almost like towards the tail end, right, for him. And but certainly there was a legacy that was passed on of stories of really hard practices and people giving great amounts of effort and energy. You know, there's stories of guys like George Romaine or Chip McCaw or Jeff Stork that just came through the program and were absolute monsters in the weight room, in the practice gym, on the sand dune, you know, wherever it was. And then they were Olympians and national champions and all these things. And so you just knew the level of effort that was required. And there was good, when I got there, the culture was really good with, Sean Rooney was there and he was really competitive to hold a standard, you know, and John was there and knew how to compete really hard and give tremendous effort, you know, and being able to communicate that, I think, with the younger players. And so coming in there, you kind of just knew the standard. I think it had been passed along and built over time. And I don't know how Marv initially started it, or if it was certain players, but I think as it went on, it's definitely the players. And then, Marv being able to, he was great about asking the right questions at the right time and making examples at the right times. And, you know, being able to follow up with people afterwards or point things out during practice, because he was never really talkative or yelling and screaming or running around, right? There was no fake energy or enthusiasm. It was just kind of a lot of conversations, a lot of behind the scenes stuff. And I think people knowing the standard of effort and given everything they had every day was just what was required.
Yeah. And I was trying to get Marv for a question here. And unfortunately we can't text message with Marv and caught his office phone a couple of times and we went back and forth. So I wasn't able to get one, unfortunately, but I know he would have a good one. So we're going to close with one from John Grobe, who you had mentioned, yeah, who had gotten in a fight with JD. hopefully they're okay now about that seam. And it's a classic outside hitter question. He asks, why didn't he set me more in system? I had to make a living off highballs.
Yep. I had to set Mayer. Yeah. No, I think what he was playing, I had Paul Carroll.
Paul Carroll, yeah.
And so Paul was getting a lot of the offense. And, you know, you're either good enough or you aren't, right? And I don't know. I think about it with setting. It's you gotta play to win. And like I feel it with the girls a little bit more. They get worried about they're not getting set. And what I would just I talk about it with them, and they think I'm joking. But just to say, like, hey, you just got to be better. You know, if you want me to set you more, just be better. Kill the ball more, please. And it, as brutal as it is, it's the reality. And you know, John knows he wasn't as good as Paul.
Yeah.
And like, you know, and so it's it just kind of is what it is. And I think John was great at high balls. He made a living of it. He just hit the ball to the back wall if it didn't touch anybody's hands, and if it did, he would make the world know that he was the best outside hitter in the world. And it was awesome, you know. Yeah. It was great for our team. It was great for him, and he had a great career doing that stuff.
You can see he's still competitive about it. He wanted more sets. So it shows you the culture was real.
Yeah.
15 years later. Yeah. Well, that's all we got. It was fun picking your brain and getting all that knowledge on setting, but also hearing kind of all you took from your time at Pepperdine. And, you know, we only got 1 year together, but I think for both of us, a really, really memorable year. And I'm glad I got to spend time again with you today, and excited to see you continue to grow that program at Fresno State. You guys are, I think there's great things ahead.
Thanks. Thanks for taking the time. It was good to remember all about setting. I don't get these deep conversations about setting all that often. As a head coach, you get a lot more things happening. When I was at Washington, you're just kind of doing setting for all day.
So fun to actually talk volleyball for once.
Yeah.
Thanks, Winder. Yeah.